Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm managing editor Matt Goldberg, and with me today are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And Dave Trumbore.
Hello.
Today we'll be discussing separating art from the artist. This is a conversation that came up because of the release of Ender's Game and the controversy surrounding it. For those who don't know, Orson Scott Card wrote the novel Ender's Game, published in 1985, and it was a big hit. It has basically been his bread and butter for years as he has continued to write prequels and sequels to it. But Orson Scott Card is also a raging homophobe, donates money to anti-homosexual causes, has spoken openly about his disdain for homosexuals, and that rubs some people the wrong way, to say the least. And so when the film, which is, they've tried to adapt it for pretty much since it came out, since the book came out and was a hit, this movie is finally coming out. And some people felt that they needed to boycott it because any money going into Orson Scott Card's pocket was therefore money that was going to anti-homosexual causes. And that they didn't feel comfortable about that. It turns out that while Orson Scott Card did receive profits from the film, that was decades ago, because he did get money when he sold the rights, and he got $1.5 million when he was asked to write the script adapting his own novel, and he was unable to adapt his own novel, which sounds like an insult, but it really isn't. I mean, it's very difficult to look at your own work and say, what am I going to cut and what am I going to leave in? And in any case, he just couldn't meet the deadline and the rights passed to another studio. And there is no clause here. There is no way that he's getting any money from this. He sold the rights in a time before authors were really savvy to how much money they could get from a successful franchise. So before
J.K.
Rowling.
Well, but still, the success of the film and possible sequels,
I understand,
all boosts, goes into the books and everything.
I understand. It boosts the visibility of the books. That being said, just from a standpoint of, I don't want to see the movie because he'll get money from the movie, isn't true. I just wanted to establish that. Orson Scott Card does not profit from sales if you go to see the movie. Your box office receipt does not go to his pocket. But yes, Adam, you're right. The money that he gets from the books this will sell, because people want to read the books compared to the movie, that's problematic for some people. Not for me personally. I've explained why on the site. But before I go on again, I already said on the site, and I've been talking already, and I want to open up the floor to you guys and your thoughts on, right now, Ender's Game, and then we can expand it to a larger discussion of art and the artist.
Yeah, the argument, first off, that boycotting this particular film with the intention of keeping money out of Orson Scott Card's pocket, again, for this particular film, like you guys just talked about, that's kind of a flawed argument. However, we've seen some sites, I think we might have posted one ourselves. I don't know if we just reported it from somebody else or if we wrote our own editorial, but it was kind of like a don't worry, he's not getting any money from this kind of thing. That's all well and good for this one particular movie, but if it does very well, a studio is probably going to look to greenlight future sequels. So I don't know if he has a deal in place, if his original deal was for just Ender's Game or if it was for sort of the entire franchise or what the particulars are of that. Do either you guys know if he had money for future sequels or just this particular movie?
I don't know if he had money for sequels. I know that it is highly unlikely they would adapt any of his other books because they are insane. They are just nutty as hell.
Nah, they get progressively a little loopier.
But I think they would just cut him off completely and just use the world to build more stories.
Yeah, but I don't know the legalities of that, though, too.
I think they own the name. I mean,
either way, Orson Scott Card would get money. They would have to buy the rights to future books or the rights to future stories. So.
Only if they use that. But what I'm saying is only if they use those books as their source material. Do they own the Ender character? Basically, do they own everything springing forth from the Ender's Game movie they have created? As long as they don't touch anything else that he has created in his other books, as long as they only use material that was represented in Ender's Game.
See, and that's the question for somebody that would happen to know the details.
Does anyone know a lawyer and have all the papers?
1-800.
1-800-LAWYER.
Lawyer. We got, but so there's the idea of future sequels from his current books that already do exist, and yeah, there are a lot of them, and they do get increasingly bizarre and crazy. I think I stopped maybe 3 or 4 after Ender's Game. But they also split off and they go into different characters as well. So, I mean, as a studio looking at this, if this movie got huge or just did crazy numbers worldwide, that's really all they're looking at, is how much money they can make from this franchise and how much longer they can keep it going. So that's why I think saying, like, oh, don't worry, if you go see this movie, he's not going to get any money, is kind of a flawed argument, because, yes, it's true in specifics with this one particular movie, but it opens up possibilities of future adaptations down the road. And to Adam's point, I think Card was online somewhere the other day saying that he was planning to write another set of books in Ender's Game's world, in Ender's world. And basically, like you said, Matt, this movie and the controversy surrounding it does shed some light and bring a spotlight to his current books that people are going to find maybe more now, because there's all this hoopla going on around it that they maybe wouldn't have before. So that it does, it's not as open and shut as if you don't see the movie, it doesn't matter. If you do see the movie, it doesn't matter, because
I'm not saying it doesn't matter. I just wanted to make sure there was a clarification, because already there was a MoveOn.org petition that was predicated on the notion that you can sink the box office of this film if you don't see it. And I just wanted to make it clear that that wasn't the case, just in this one thing. I'm not saying...
Well, but you... Okay, so if people actually did boycott it and it had a crap performance at the box office, then there wouldn't be a question. There is no question that he's getting any more money from this particular movie. We've already said that a number of times. However, if you would have sank the box office, then the studio is probably like, all right, it's really not worth it to continue with future movies. However, if it crosses, you know, if it makes twice whatever its budget was, which I don't know if it's even going to do that, so this might all be a moot point, then that opens the possibility for future work with him, which just, you know, is the can of worms. It's this whole kind of thing all over again in the future. And him being more savvy now, he knows how much to ask for in the future. Not $1.5 million to write the own script. He's going to get... You know, ideally for him, he would get a hell of a lot more money for franchise rights and character rights and things like that. Sure. I think that's the important part to take away from it, too.
Okay. That is a fair point. I personally still believe, though, that, well, two things.
Mm-hmm.
First off, is that I'm a little cold on boycotts in the way that they exist in the internet age, just because I believe it's slacktivism. I believe that boycotts, as they are thought of, the boycotts, when we hear the word boycott, at least for me, my mind immediately goes to African Americans boycotting businesses in the South as a show to end segregation.
Right.
And if you are a small business owner in the South, if you have a restaurant and your restaurant is segregated and you still want African Americans to come there, you just want them to sit in their own section. Well, if they boycott your restaurant outright, you've lost a huge amount of your profits.
Mm-hmm.
But in the age of the internet, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way that if you just stay home, then a global franchise is going to sink that way.
Right.
Furthermore, my problem with it as far as slacktivism goes is that it basically says, don't do something. Like, the extent of your participation is don't buy money and leave your house. And I just wanted to read this very clearly from the MoveOn.org petition.
Mm-hmm.
Ender's Game author Orson Scott Card is a bigot who wants to see the destruction of LGBT marriage equality and will use his earnings from the movie Ender's Game to oppose mm-hmm. gay rights. Pledge to skip Ender's Game and ensure your entertainment dollars don't support homophobia. That's it. All you have to do is skip it. And, well, for me, that's very, like, why not say, let's go out and protest these screenings? Pick up a sign. Go spend an evening, for God's sakes, at least standing around. Say what you will about Catholics, but hell, they got up and went to go protest dogma. They weren't lazy about it. I mean, I completely disagree with them, but they took the time. And it frustrates me that people would believe this insofar as it doesn't inconvenience them in any way.
Right.
That rubs me the wrong way.
Well, it's also more of a positive, like a point positive kind of thing. It's more like spend your dollars. I don't know how this really applies in this particular case, but rather than don't spend something or don't go do something, Matt, to your point, like it should point positive and say, go do something else. Do something else that, you know, helps, what's the word? Advocacy organization or volunteer some time there, something like that. You know, put spin people in a positive direction at least and help get the word out to explain why this is a controversy and why it's upset a lot of people. Not just, oh, I guess I just won't go out this Friday and spend that $10 on that one movie and then just forget about it forever, because that doesn't really do anything.
Well, in the concept of rallying around a boycott of Ender's Game is so strange, because it's not like the film is like promoting anti-gay views or anything. It's just this incredibly like compassionate story with these really strong resonating themes that seem so far away from Orson Scott Card's personal beliefs and everything that it feels weird to go out and say, like, don't see this movie that has these really like compassionate and sweet and like wonderful themes that rarely get into franchise movies just because we don't like the author. Like, it's I think it's such a curious case, and I mean I'm sure we'll get into it later, but it's so weird to think that this story came from the same guy who spouts off all these homophobic thoughts that are really hurtful and mean. It seems just completely opposite of what the themes of Ender's Game are.
See, now with that, you get exactly to the crux of my own personal issue and kind of struggle with this this movie, because I've read Ender's Game when I was like 12, and it's still one of my favorite books or stories of all time. And when this all kind of came out, because I mean that was before like the age of the internet had really dawned, and I wasn't a Mormon, so I didn't know what was going on in the LDS. So I didn't know any of that stuff until fairly recently. I had no clue that the person who wrote a story about a little kid who's ostracized and he feels unwanted, and he's kind of like physically literally put in the corner a number of times over and over and over again, and he rises above to kind of like do the best that he can. And I'm not going to give anything away from the story, but that kind of a mind to create that kind of story and spell it out so well, and then you find out that that guy is the same one who's speaking out against homosexuals and basically calling them deficient and saying that they're sinful.
He's
and there's
a bully.
Something.
He's being a bully.
It makes zero sense. And I have yet to be able to reconcile those two thoughts in my head. And that's really my main issue with the movie. For me personally, it has nothing to do with the money, the box office, anything like that. It's just I can't reconcile the fact that someone who wrote one of my favorite stories growing up, and that's very, very formative for me, is the same person that we're talking about in this conversation. So I feel like for me to watch that movie, I would have those competing thoughts in my head. Like every time I enjoyed a scene because I loved it in the book, you know, that other voice would be like, oh, by the way, he hates gays. And it's just like a weird, that's a very, very strange movie going experience to have. I don't really think that anyone else has really, you know, that's never really come up before. So well, I personally haven't gone to see it because I haven't reconciled that, those two feelings or emotions or whatever to the point where I can enjoy the movie and separate him out of it. I haven't gotten there yet.
Well, Dave, let me ask you this. Do you have that problem with other filmmakers and this is the filmmaker, someone who actually had something to do with the making of the movie, and you find their beliefs distasteful? Or, for instance, can you ever watch Braveheart again? I don't know if you liked Braveheart or not, but can you ever see yourself seeing Braveheart and being like, oh, I don't know if I can do this? Or even a film of Roman Polanski, or Woody Allen did something very icky by marrying his adopted daughter. Yeah. Like,
he never legally adopted her, just to be fair.
Oh, much better. And then we're all cool with it, because I think we're aware of why it would be controversial. Can we at least agree on that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. 100%.
Sure. But, and what I'm asking is, do you carry that baggage into their movies?
So I was, I'm not really a film student by nature, so I didn't really know a lot of the controversies that were associated with certain directors going into it. Obviously, Polanski is like the most well-known, the most infamous. So anytime, you even hear the name, I just go back to like the Family Guy joke about him, and that still makes me cringe.
What's the Family Guy joke? Because
the Family Guy joke, real quick, Stewie has like the neighbor kid, and he's like, I think he like kidnapped him, and he has him like tied up in ropes and chains, like in a chair in the basement. And Lois comes down, and is like, "What are you kids doing?" And Stewie's like, "We're playing house." And like they kind of like look at each other because the kid's all tied up on a chair, and he's like, "Roman Polanski's house." And that just that just still makes me cringe.
Really? Because
just knowing, like, connecting that to it, and then I don't know. It's just
I don't know. I thought the joke would be misconstrued, like, because Roman Polanski's house is where the Manson family murders happened.
Well, that too. So I mean, there's a lot
which
of
had nothing to do with him, other than
his house and his
pregnant wife getting murdered.
And that's funny that always seems to get like nobody really pays attention to that. Like, oh, I wonder if that really fucked that guy up. Like,
he was
lot.
Also a Holocaust survivor.
I know.
That's
so,
the other thing.
There's a lot going on.
He has been through some shit.
He has been, and some of it of his own making.
Exactly, and that's like the inexcusable part of it too. Like, yeah, you might be fucked up, and you might have reasons that can explain.
Well, yeah, and it's inexcusable, obviously. Yeah. But going back to the point of can you ever see a Roman Polanski film, or can you ever see a Woody Allen film, or can you ever see Jeepers Creepers, or can you ever see a Mel Gibson movie, so on and so forth.
I mean, for me personally, I don't often seek out like a Polanski or even a Woody Allen or any of these other numbers, like a Lars von Trier. Is that his name, Trier?
Yeah.
Or a Harmony Korine or people like that, which we can get into the difference between the personal artist doing something horrendous in their life versus doing something horrendous in your work, which I think is an important distinction that a lot of people kind of lose sight of. They think that art is reality, even if their reality happens to reflect their art or vice versa. But yeah, like I wouldn't go seek out a Polanski movie. This for me, or even a Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson is a good question, because I've been a fan of Gibson's work for a really long time, but he's obviously a pretty terrible individual. So yeah, I may not decide to support his future work. But as far as Ender's Game and Orson Scott Card go, that's way more personal to me than pretty much anybody that you can list. That anybody else that you could list. So it's kind of a weird spot that I'm in.
Well, do you think that, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, that's fine.
Do you think that future films from Woody Allen, from Roman Polanski, do you think those should have the same kind of boycotts?
Definitely in Polanski's case, because, I mean, he's made how many films since 77 and since all the details of kind of his horrendous episodes came out and were documented in court cases. And some people will say, like, I don't know if he's actually gone through the entire process and has been not acquitted, but
he was about to be sentenced.
Here's to give a very quick run through.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was, yes, he did. He raped a 13-year-old girl. And under the system of he was going to have a plea bargain. And the plea bargain was agreed to. Again, the actions, again, horrendous, but there is a legal system in place.
Right.
He was going to be sentenced, and then the judge and the DA, who were basically being fame whores and saw an opportunity to basically further their own careers throughout the deal, and were basically going to sentence him, despite the fact that they had made a deal that Polanski had agreed to. And this circus actually ended up getting the victim, the 13-year-old victim, and I want to make sure I pronounce her name correctly. Grimmer. What was her first name? Samantha Grimmer.
Mm.
And so she became sort of swept up in this as well, simply because they were dragging it out, and it became a much bigger drama than it needed to be, because it simply could have just been over. So since they didn't agree to it, he fled the country a few hours before he's supposed to be sentenced. He is a French citizen. He has French citizenship. So he basically stood there. The French never extradited him. Over the years, what's transpired is that he has apologized. Not that it excuses it, but he has apologized for it. He has not returned to face sentencing. But again, that's the argument over, was it ever fair in the first place under a legal system that is supposed to be fair, regardless of the crime? Furthermore, Grenier has forgiven him in the sense of she accepts that she was that they were. I'm actually going to read her statement because I don't want to butcher this. This is important. During a television interview, this is from Wikipedia, on March 10th, 2011. Grimier blamed the media, reporters, the court, and the judge for causing, quote, way more damage to her and her family than anything Roman Polanski has ever done.
Right.
And stated that the judge was using her and a noted celebrity for his own personal gain and for the media exposure. So she's holding other people accountable as well that don't get drawn into it because they're not Roman Polanski. This is a hazy issue with a clear moral wrong in it, a clear, not even moral, just something plainly wrong, but a set of circumstances that then gets, I don't know if confabulated is the right word, but it gets piled onto. So now he's a fugitive who escaped justice because he didn't like it. Well, no, there it's more complicated than that and how the victims respond over time to that. But from there, people have a set idea that anything Roman Polanski touches now is wrong, no matter the quality of what he has made. You know, The Pianist is a great movie, but he made it after, you know, the accusation. And furthermore, does that invalidate what happened before he had done the crime? Or is that okay? Right. Is that on the right side of the division where you can accept those works but not anything after?
Right.
See, I think it's...
Because, I mean, okay, we'll go on. Go on, Adam. What are you going to say?
Well, I've been having this discussion a lot with some friends lately about kind of Ender's Game and separating the art from the artist. And, you know, we were talking and, you know, every human being has done bad things. And I think it's a case-by-case basis. You know, I'm sure there are plenty of filmmakers or actors or artists who have done terrible, terrible things behind closed doors that we don't know about. But I think, I mean, taking someone like Woody Allen, for instance, like, yes, it's icky that, you know, he fell in love with his wife's 19-year-old adopted daughter, but the fact remains they've been together for 15 years. Like, it wasn't some like sexually like gross thing that happened and it's over with. Like, they have been together. But then someone like Victor Salva, like Jeepers Creepers, I cannot in any way support. Like, he is a convicted sex offender for molesting young boys. Like, that is not something that's forgivable.
See, I didn't even know that because that was news to me. I was wondering why you threw Jeepers Creepers in earlier and now.
Yeah. I think it comes to a point of not wanting to reward or kind of say that behavior is okay. Like, right. Chris Brown, for instance, like, I think he shows no remorse. He did a terrible thing and he's just an asshole about it. So I think in that case, like, boycotting that music, no one buying that music, like, that guy just not rewarding his behavior or not saying it's okay, like, we forgive you because you're such a great artist. Like, if Adolf Hitler had directed The Godfather, it would be better that The Godfather didn't exist because he's Adolf Hitler. So I think it's shades of gray. We don't live in a world that's black and white. There are not good guys, there are not bad guys. And so any director who has done something bad doesn't automatically make their films bad. It's a case-by-case basis. I think Polanski is a more murkier issue than someone like Woody Allen. But, you know, it's interesting and it's tough to separate yourself. So, but I mean, everyone has a line that they draw and everyone has, you know, a point that they come to. I know there are still plenty of people who won't see a Polanski or Woody Allen films.
Well, Adam, since you brought in Hitler, which I always
well,
recommend
to
again,
take it to take it. To
no,
the most
I know, but
things.
I actually want to bring this in because it's very important. Lenny Riefenstahl made Triumph of the Will, which is a Nazi propaganda movie. Mm-hmm. But from a filmmaking perspective, it is amazing. Let's go even further back to Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation is a horribly racist film. At the end of the day, the Ku Klux Klan saves the day from freed slaves. It is horrible in its message. It is one of the most important films of all time from a filmmaking, not a storytelling, but a filmmaking perspective. So do we just write and say, sorry, the content of this is just too atrocious to even acknowledge the craftsmanship. It's just too hard. Do we just ignore history because we find its origins or something about it distasteful? Because if it doesn't fit into a perfect box of I approve, if you can stamp it and say I approve, then it has to be negated.
See, to me, that's an important distinction to make, too, between a controversial film and then a controversial filmmaker, though, too, because a lot of these, I was looking up just basically controversial filmmakers, and most of them were just like because they had written or depicted some pretty nasty stuff on screen, whereas their personal life at least wasn't publicized to be all that terrible. I'm looking up D.W. Griffith now because I don't know his personal history. He was the director of the film Matt just talked about.
Birth of a Nation.
Pretty racist dude.
Yeah, Birth of a Nation, right. Pretty racist dude, I would imagine.
Well, when you make a film like Birth of a Nation, you're probably, yeah. I mean, and when you make Triumph of the Will, you're not going to begrudgingly make Triumph of the Will.
You're not doing it ironically, yeah.
I guess I'll pick Triumph of the Will now.
But that's the thing. It's sort of like those types of filmmakers are looking to sort of create contra, maybe not even looking to, but they know that they're going to stir up a lot of people with it. So it's, you kind of have to,
they were being antagonistic. I think in terms of Birth of a Nation and Triumph of the Will, they honestly believed, like, why would anyone dislike this? Especially Triumph of the Will. Yeah, it wants to stir people up in terms of nationalism. Right. It wants to stir them up to feel good, not to... It does, from the perspective of filmmaker intent. So, again, yes, it's them making horrible movies and doing horrible things, but... You can't just write it off. It's how important it is. And in terms of, if you want to look at a cause and effect, in the American Film Institute came out back in 97 with their top 100 films of the last 100 years. So the top 100 American movies of the last 100 years. Birth of a Nation was in the top 10. Because it's that influential. And it really raised the ire of groups like the NAACP.
Sure.
And so in the 10 years later, they came out with another list, and Birth of a Nation had been replaced with Intolerance, which is a more palatable...
D.W. Griffith's apology, basically.
Pretty much. Yeah. But to me, that's caving to pressure and ignoring that, again, yes, it is offensive in content, but as filmmakers, it would be covering up history. It would be ignoring historical value.
Sure.
So again, of course, it's horrible to put those things in there, but at the same time, how can you bury it? How can you just ignore it and say, well, I'm sorry, this isn't palatable. This isn't, you know, you don't like this. I understand why you don't like it, but does that mean we should just bury it and make sure no one knows about it?
Well, let me pitch this to you. I don't know if this is how this all kind of worked out back in 1915 and 16, but so Birth of a Nation came from Griffith's own, I don't know, probably, obviously beliefs, but probably experiences and upbringing.
Well,
and
it comes from also from a book called The Klansman. It's an adaptation.
So it was an adaptation, okay. So, yeah, I don't really know too much about any of that, but it was obviously something that was kind of...
He still chose to adapt it. I'm not excusing him. I'm just saying he didn't.
No. I'm not excusing him at that point either. But basically, his react or the people's reaction to that film, I feel like maybe opened his eyes to the fact that, hey, maybe there's something wrong with my particular belief system, and that's where Intolerance kind of came through. Again, I don't know. I'm just kind of like just supposing in this case that basically what I want to say is that a filmmaker's vision, while it may not be palatable to everyone, it is their original creation. Whatever message they want to get across is what they're trying to do. Maybe that opens their eyes to their own intolerances in the future, or maybe it opens somebody else's eyes that happens to be viewing the film. So there is definitely some worth to it. As far as, I mean, did Griffith go on to do a lot more after that? You guys seem to know more about him than I do.
Well, I mean, I know Griffith. I mean, I know, again, he's one of the most influential simply by virtue. And he was also, I believe, one of the founding members of United Artists, along with Charlie Chaplin. And
yeah, he was.
He was, yeah. I know some film. I have a degree.
I hope so, yeah. I got nothing over here. So I'm just saying, like, it's one of those things that you don't necessarily have to like it, but the fact that it exists does influence someone somewhere along the way, so it's good that it was brought out into the open. Because a lot of this stuff, any of these kind of like taboo subjects, which are becoming less taboo as we become more kind of connected and more outspoken and have people willing to, I don't know, even just so little as sign a move on or whatever it is, petition, people are at least becoming more and more aware of things. It's not as if homosexuality only existed in the last, you know, 20 years, or racism only existed since D.W. Griffith came on the screen.
Just to note, D.W. Griffith has 534 directorial credits, so he did do some other stuff.
Yeah, he did do quite a bit then. So I'd be curious to see if he became
how his filmography changed in response. Yeah, I haven't seen. In fact, Birth of a Nation is the only one I've seen. But again, okay. I've seen it, and no, I can speak. Yes, and it's 3 hours long too. It's a 3-hour silent movie about the Klan saving the day and how black people are lazy and will
ruin America. Yeah, but good luck trying to make that today. Good luck trying to make that today is all I'm saying.
That is true. You could not. You couldn't make. You couldn't do a remake of Birth of a Nation.
Brett Ratner is remaking Birth of a Nation.
Oh Lord!
But you can.
See, I would protest that just because of Brett Ratner, not because of the content.
Right.
See,
well,
and that for me, it becomes a personal issue of not rewarding someone's behavior with my money, or not rewarding like this person, or acknowledging that it is okay. And so it's tough for me to like go back in history to like talk about something like Birth of a Nation because I'm not around to do it. But if it came out at that time, I would feel very strongly like, you know, someone like that saying something like this is not okay, and they should be told that it's not okay.
Well, let me ask you this then, Adam. Would you ever, knowing its historical value, would you ever pay to see Birth of a Nation today?
I mean,
now D.W. Griffith is quite dead.
Yeah, so the profits are going to, I'm sure, I don't even know who owns
his
that
estate
film,
yeah.
So.
Is it state, or maybe it's public domain at this point? I'm not sure.
Amazon, so you don't have to pay anything. So that's fun.
Okay, let's okay. Theoretically,
if the money's going to D.W. Griffith, no, I would not pay to see it.
Okay, so you would just okay, fair enough. So despite its tremendous value, because
I think at the end of the day, real life trumps fiction, and no matter how masterful a piece of art can be, I think that you have to step outside yourself and think about like what's happening here in the here and now, and like who these real life people behind these things.
See, it is interesting how the kind of the social commentary and context changes to reflect kind of what is and what is not acceptable by just kind of, I want to say the masses, but it, you know, if that film came out today, wow, I can't even think of the repercussions for something
well,
like that.
Dave,
it would never open wide, that's for sure.
This is what it wants to tie back. This ties back into what I said in my article about Orson Scott Card not making any money. And I've written this before. I wrote this on my personal site about people boycotting Chick-fil-A because Chick-fil-A is a very religious organization.
Right.
And the money that you get, they spend money towards, you know, anti-homosexual causes.
Mm-hmm.
And my reasoning for giving money to both, I paid for my copy of Ender's Game, the book, and I've never stopped going to Chick-fil-A, is because social mores have changed.
Right.
And so back in the 1980s, if you pay for those things, now at the time you probably wouldn't even know. But assuming you did, yeah, you'd probably be like, no, this is a really, things are very tense right now. And that's not to say homosexuality is solved. Like there are I think 30 states left that still where gay marriage is still not legal. But the tide has turned. It's irreversible now. Almost everyone at least knows one gay person. Could be a gay friend, could it be a gay family member. And it came more from people in the gay community slowly feeling like they could come out. I had a friend in high school. And she was one of my best friends, still is one of my best friends, but I didn't know any gay people up to that point. She came out. I'm like, oh, we're still friends. It's something where once you understand the person, you have a human face on it, then no amount of money that Orson Scott Card or the founders of Chick-fil-A, they can donate to make you see that person differently. And it just spreads out like that where you just know people or they know people. And the positivity of that group trumps anything they could do. So I'm actually more than happy to give those people their money, give Chick-fil-A and Orson Scott Card my money, because they're going to waste it. They are just going to flush it down the toilet. And I think about all the other things they could spend it on, like how much they could make their own lives better in terms of like what they could buy and what they own. And they're like, I'm going to spend it. You could basically, as I said in my article, your money would be better spent trying to bring back pagers. You'd be better spent trying to make sure that the moon doesn't cause to control the tides. It just doesn't happen. It is. You can throw that money to any organization.
If
there's an organization, they'll be like, yes, let's stop the moon. Probably. There probably is some batshit organization out there. And you can donate your money to them. That's fine. You're free to use your money however you want. And again, I understand people believing that, in this case, that money's going to go there. For me, and I'm sure some people are like, it's just a rationalization. Mm-hmm. But I'm just looking at the landscape. Okay, look around you and see that what you're doing here is, just think about it practically. And for me, it's more important to understand practically what that money goes to. And for me, they're wasting their money. And to say, I'm going to boycott it. And again, boycott meaning not do something, right. Not pick up a sign, not go spend any time, not write a letter or anything like that. Not do something is feel goodism. It's feeling that you're making a difference when you're not, okay? And that's the thing. You're not even willing to put in the effort to try to stand up for what you believe in as much as not buying something.
Yeah, honestly, most of this was just about bringing more public attention to the issue of homosexual rights. That's really it. That's kind of why that petition was so poorly worded and so kind of thin, because they basically like listed what he had said in his past statements, and they basically just... They try to get people on an emotional... they try to stick them emotionally, so they get them fired up, and they're like, yeah, you should totally boycott this because this and this, and then keep the money out of his hands because he's a terrible person. And they get people on an emotional level, and it probably works for a lot of people, and then probably a lot of people just kind of forget about it. I wouldn't be surprised if there were a lot of people that signed the boycott, and they were just like, oh, that looks pretty good, and just went and checked it out anyway.
Like, I think I signed something a few months ago.
What's sad about it is that the same people that the boycott would work on, like the same, like if I didn't know anything about it and I had just heard that, I would say, oh, like I'm not sure if I want to give my money to it. Just kind of have a general understanding of what's going on, right. Are the same people who would appreciate the values in the film. Like it is not just some sci-fi movie about a little boy like shooting aliens. Like it is so not that. And that's what's so, I was so surprised to see like the themes that were on display in it. And it's just, it makes no sense. Like how does someone like Orson Scott Card have it in him to write that book and then say these things? I can't reconcile that.
Well, see,
that's can't either, and that's the issue. That's part of his split personality kind of thing.
It's a split personality, and so, but I guess Adam is going back to say that even if the movie were an inverse, if the movie represented something positive, if the repercussions go to someone negative, you can't support the movie because, again, it's antithetical. So, the antithesis of the values portrayed in the movie. So wouldn't it therefore be good for people to see the movie because they'll understand like, oh, empathy is really important. And empathy is a huge theme in the book
and understanding people who are different from you and
exactly
right. Yeah. So it's ironic, but it is it's ironic least, yeah. In terms of the content, but if you can just ignore Orson Scott Card, and I believe you can't, in the terms of just seeing this one movie, mm-hmm. and yes, there are ramifications, but you're not buying the book. You can't tell anyone to see it, and just because you see it, I understand, like, oh, but then it boosts up the box office, and then you do this. Marketing already took care of that. It already took care of that long ago. And really, isn't the more lasting impact is that you saw a story that conveys a more important value. I guess that's the question. Is the value of the story outweigh a guy who is shouting at the wind?
And that's why, to me, to answer your question...
He's shouting at the wind!
No, he is. He totally is.
I know, I'm just picturing that in my head, a man outside shouting at the wind.
It's probably not too far from reality most days, actually. I feel like he's kind of going off his rocker a little bit. But, to answer your question that you posed, well, just now and earlier, I will see this movie eventually, because I've been waiting for a movie adaptation of this for pretty much since I read the book originally. I was like, oh, that would make a fantastic book. But for me personally right now, I'm not part of the boycott in any organized sense, other than in my own personal boycott of, I can't see this right now because I couldn't enjoy the film because I have all of his kind of baggage that's like weighing on me. So to me, it's almost like, you know, you train as a musician your whole life and you have certain musicians that you look up to, and then one day, I don't know, you get to open for them, you meet them backstage before you go out, and they're just complete assholes or just like the worst possible person you could have seen, and it just completely shatters your perception of
what
they
were. Oh yeah, never meet your idols. Never meet your idols, because then you're rolling the dice.
And that's kind of where I'm at as far as on my own personal level. However, I do think you can separate the art from the artist. because it's sort of just a, it's an object that they have created along the way. And I think as long as you know the context going into it, that can alter your perception of what you take away from it and how you perceive it and how you criticize it, definitely. But to deprive yourself of whatever that experience happens to be, whether it's a song, shit, whether it's a sporting event with some of these horrendous athletes that continue to play and make millions of dollars out there today, or whether it's a movie based on a book by an author that has some personal beliefs that you disagree with, I think to deprive yourself from that, you are literally doing nothing but depriving yourself of that experience, because you can take something from it, even if it's a even if it just, you just come away with reinforced beliefs from what you went in believing, if that makes any sense.
Sure, absolutely. And I would like to just make clear to our listeners right now, none of us are supporting censorship. No one is saying, right. I assume, no. None of us are saying, no, these artists don't even have the right to do this. None of us are saying that. We're saying that they have the absolute right to make it, and some people, and obviously everyone has the right to not see it. Right. We're all saying, okay, so we're on the same page with that. Yep. So I just wanted to make that abundantly clear. I would also like to make the distinction that I think, it, at least for me, it's easier to except any artist who isn't visible, in the sense that looking at Roman Polanski, well, Roman Polanski doesn't act in his movies, and his act, his the rape, there's not film of it, it wasn't seen, anything like that. This is all to say, Mel Gibson, it's a lot harder to see him in movies. Yeah. It is, because it's all visible. In fact, it was still
him.
Exactly. See, before that, he was still like, oh, you know, he got arrested in the transcript, like he called the officer sugar tits, and all the wars in the world are, Jews are responsible for all the wars in the world. Fun comments like that. And it's on the record, but you never heard it. And then you got the tapes. And there's a reason that Mel Gibson will probably be playing villains for a very, very long time.
Well, look at the roles that he's done, too. He's no longer like the savior of a of an entire culture of peoples, or he's not, you know, the leading man and everything. What's he done since pretty much all of his tirades and 911 calls and all
this? He can't get his movies made. You're supposed to do a Viking movie with Leo DiCaprio that was going to be like his next Braveheart, but DiCaprio
he's had
left
his,
and nobody
he's had his hand in a beaver puppet, and he's been
which
in,
was made before the tapes came out.
Exactly.
And I think How to Get the Gringo, which or Get the Gringo,
yeah,
that was made before the tapes. So the only two things he's done are Machete, and right now he's doing Expendables 3, where he's also playing the villain. So those two roles thus far. Who knows what you know? What lies before him? Now, there's also, again, there, and see, that's the thing. What he did was really mean-spirited, and not like, there are different levels of scandal. Like, for a long time, or for a sizable amount of Chanko time, Rob Lowe had to play skeezy characters or bad guys because there was a sex tape with him. With, I don't know if the girls were underage, but they were definitely very young.
Rob Lowe.
No, it was one girl. It was two dudes. It was two dudes and one girl. It was Rob Lowe and his friend, and then an underage girl.
Oh, and an underage girl. Yeah, okay. And so, but like a six, not like a child. It was like a 16.
No, 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 no. It was like 16, 17.
Yeah.
And
either way.
I think there were multiple sex tapes, but that guy has more than come back from.
He has more than come back. Exactly.
Well, that
time,
just goes to show that
time
our,
wasted
our
away, and he's very likable. And again, and we're forgiving. I mean, I'm sure.
Exactly.
I mean, he was very young at the time.
Yeah.
And exactly. But Adam, you're right. He's more than made up for it. But I look at West Wing, and I look at Parks and Rec, and then I look at Tommy Boy, because Tommy Boy is when he was still serving time, and he has to be the villain in Tommy Boy.
Right.
Yeah.
So there are different.
And he's
levels
a creepy
here.
Villain in that, though, too. There's a lot of weird, creepy
oh,
stuff.
Oh, yeah, there's creepy stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Again, so the public bears an image for a time. But again, I think the conversation is more interesting when we're talking about artists and things that we know. That's something else that I want to just briefly get into, which is, there was a comedian, unfortunately his name is escaping me, but he did a bit on Chick-fil-A, and something he was talking against was, he was making the point that now that you know it is bad, you have to stop doing it. As long as you're operating under ignorance, it's okay, but once you know it, you shouldn't keep doing it. And my feeling is, if you, that extends way past movies. like that extends to things that you own in real life. Like my iPhone was made pretty much by slave labor. It was all so much of our technology is made by people who their jobs need suicide nets. Mm-hmm. Not an exaggeration. They literally have suicide nets because the people are killing themselves because their lives are so horrible. On the other hand, not to rip off Louis C.K.'s bit, but it is. No, it's absolutely... However, it's absolutely true that we have our limits of compassion because we hate being inconvenienced.
Right.
That's to me...
Well, it's also out of sight, out of mind, too.
It's absolutely out of sight, out of mind, but that's the thing. I've put it in your sight and I've put it in your mind. If you didn't know this, now you do. The choice is now up to you. Just
and
as
that's
the choice
what I think
was,
the boycott was really, really about is just the spotlighting the issue. Because most people just be like, oh, Ender's Game, that sounds cool. Looks like a sci-fi kind of action-y thing. Oh, wait a minute, who's this guy? Like, because who gives a shit for the most part, unless your name is Stephanie Meyer or J.K. Rowling. Honestly, most people have no idea who writes movies these days, unless they're based off of something already. So the fact that they...
Yeah. And they don't even know how it works.
Well, that too, exactly. The fact that he wrote a script that wasn't even made 25 years
ago. I had a friend tell me that adaptations were probably really easy. You just do the book. I was like, no.
No.
They're talking about Harry Potter.
Do the book.
I was like, no. Unless you're Chris Columbus, no.
Unless you're Chris Columbus or yeah. People who are upset that the Lord of the Rings movies don't follow the books to a T. Where the fuck is Tom Bombadil? Well... Funny story. He's boring and slows the plot down tremendously. That's where he is. But that's a whole nother topic of the troubles of adaptation. The problem of artist and art is that, honestly, there are a lot of artists and art, you know, promoting horrible things at the time. I mean, Merchant of Venice is really anti-Semitic. But I don't think anyone's going to say, fuck William Shakespeare. I mean, is that correct? I mean, sometimes their beliefs and even the art does horrible things, but there are degrees. And I think my William Shakespeare example is probably on the opposite end of the spectrum from the Hitler thing. We've taken it to extremes to make a point. Yeah. And I don't know if our point has been helped by going to those extremes.
It's shades of gray.
It
there is no black and white.
50
it is.
Shades, case by
God
case.
Damn it! I was hoping no one said 50 Shades of Grey.
Well, but that's the thing too. Is like people are looking for pretty much anything to get upset about in any movies that come out that are more or less based off of successful book adaptations. Do you remember the sort of boycotts of the Harry Potter movies because quote unquote witchcraft?
Oh yeah,
them?
Yeah, yeah.
So they existed. Yeah. Twilight. I mean, a lot of people boycott it just based on bad taste alone. Which I think is fine. So there's probably going to be some weird 50
and
Shades of Grey.
What's weird is like, what is a boycott at this point? Is a boycott implies organization and movement as opposed to boycott is a group of people who are like, no, I'm not going to say that.
Boycott Grown Ups 2 by just not seeing it.
What did you boycott Grown Ups 2?
Well, if boycott just means not seeing it, like if I didn't see Grown Ups 2, technically I boycotted it. Like,
here's another. Yeah. And if we're going to talk boycotts, I mean, really, the boycott there shouldn't have extended to Ender's Game. What the boycott should have been is I'm not going to see any Lionsgate or Summit Entertainment movie.
Yeah, hit the studio. Yeah. Which the studio did a pretty good job, I think, of coming out ahead of it and just being like, nope, we're not in league with that wacko.
We are in
we're
league with Roberto Orci, this wacko, with his crazy conspiracy bullshit.
We're a one wacko policy.
We're just a one wacko policy here at Lionsgate and Summit.
That's what makes me think there probably won't be any sequels or anything, because like just like on top of the box office was just kind of so-so, but just like I don't think they want to go through that shitstorm again. I know they had a really tough time because Carr just kept talking; he just kept saying things.
Yep.
They'd keep pushing stuff back and changing their marketing strategy.
Yeah, I think the movie will be a hit. I mean, it opened at expectations, or even maybe a little bit above, and then there's the worldwide box office. But I think you're right. I think it's not necessarily that even the movie. It's not a huge. It's not an in like a success that's too big to ignore. I think it will be a success, but not.
But
worth,
it's no Hunger Games.
It's no Hunger Games, and it's not worth the trouble. It's not worth the trouble of going again. So I think everyone on the film who made it, because I like the movie, and I think they should be proud of what they did. But from a studio standpoint, it's just like, no, we got it. We're good here. The accomplishment is getting it made after a couple decades.
See, and that's such the shitty part of it is like, okay, you guys are saying, well, at least Matt, you're saying that it's a decent film. And that's great. But the fact that it's overshadowed.
You disagree?
Yeah, I should let you guys talk about the actual film.
I had some issues with it, but...
Okay. We don't have to go into it. I mean,
I didn't think it was a bad film. I just felt like it didn't focus enough on the moral ambiguity and the character stuff. It was so quickly paced and it ends so abruptly that it was just like no time to breathe. I mean, I understood it and I really appreciated the themes and everything. I just wish there were more. I wish there was more focus on character, more focus on wrestling with these tough issues. And
I definitely think I agree. I think it definitely shies away from the darkness, but I also think that it doesn't remove the complexity of Ender's characters and the inner conflict within him, and I like that. And I think the action is well done. I think the book ends kind of abruptly as well, so that one didn't really bother me.
Yeah, I remember the book. As a movie.
Yeah, so that didn't really... And again, I know that they should be separate, but I guess I was prepared, in a sense, for that.
Do you guys think the marketing kind of ruined the surprise, or did the movie kind of take a different tack on that?
I never thought that the marketing ruined the surprise. I think...
I didn't either. And I knew the twist early on. That's why I never finished the book, because someone told me the twist, and I was like,
right.
Why am I going to read the book now?
Yeah, I didn't know the twist going into the book, and even knowing the twist, but once I knew the twist, I finished the book before the marketing had really ramped up. But I looked for it, and I'm like, they haven't given it away. They really.
So that's why I wasn't sure, because like as someone who had known it for a while, and like I'd reread it, like it was kind of obvious to me in the marketing, but that's probably just because I was looking for it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
They play it really well in the movie. It's very surprising the way
Yeah, I think
it.
if
I thought Butterfield was great. I just wish they would have like add 10 or 15 minutes more to it, have more character stuff, would have been happier.
And I think that as an adaptation, it does cut out the stuff that should be cut out, which is in the book there's a whole subplot about his sister and his brother basically taking over the internet to create a false controversy that will then catapult them to power. It's like, it's gone. Well, this definitely isn't going to work in a movie. So that I think also as an adaptation, it's pretty well done. And I think from Gavin Hood, it's a statement that no, X-Men Origins Wolverine is not my fault. I know how to direct a movie.
Wolverine.
That poor guy, man. I mean, he's got that, and now he's got this thing, which is just like mired in the controversy. So,
I think he'll be fine. I think he'll be fine because I don't think it reflects poorly on him as a person. I think again, the movie opened to mixed to positive reviews. I think that's pretty much. So, I think he'll be fine. And I'll be interested. And to me, honestly, I think Soci is his best film, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But this is his best film since there, because I didn't really like Rendition at all.
Well, until he directs Brett Ratner's Birth of a Nation remake.
Until someone handles the Birth of a Nation remake. I mean, we all know who's perfect for it. It's Mel Gibson. All right, you guys want to move on to recommendations?
Sure.
All right, sure. Dave, what do you got for us?
Lord, give me a second. I got to look something up here because I wasn't Johnny on the spot. So maybe Adam, if you got one ready.
Yeah, Adam, you go ahead.
Sure. In keeping with the separating artists from art themes, I am recommending Woody Allen's 1979 masterpiece, Manhattan. I'm sure you've heard of this movie. It's one of Allen's many, many collaborations with screenwriter Marshall Brickman. And it's one of his best films. It was shot in black and white, and Allen plays a newly divorced comedy writer who is dating a 17-year-old. That's interesting.
Uh-oh.
He eventually falls in love with his best friend's mistress, played by Diane Keaton. It's kind of I wouldn't say a sequel, maybe like a spiritual sequel to Annie Hall. It kind of furthers the on-screen chemistry between Keaton and Allen, and it's got great cast, great work from Meryl Streep and Mariel Hemingway, who plays his the woman that he's dating, and she was also a very young actress. I think she was like 16 playing the 17-year-old, and she's really great in it. But it's gorgeous cinematography, great story, great character work, fantastic screenplay. If you haven't seen it, I mean, this one's on kind of a must-see list for any film aficionados. But just because it's in black and white doesn't mean it's boring. It's very interesting.
Adam, everything in black and white is boring. Come on.
Manhattan, if you haven't seen it, I know it was on Netflix Instant Watch recently, so it might still be on there. But check it out.
Okay. Dave, what about you?
I got one out of left field today. I just watched this week, so that's why it was on my mind. It is another adaptation of I wouldn't even call him controversial author. I'm pretty sure everybody loves him, even though his stories, in which he's written a lot of them, are pretty dark and fucked up, but he's always kind of on the side of the good guy. It's real easy to see which guys are the shitty characters, and they're the ones who act with intolerance and bullying and hatred of other people. We're going to go with 1990's Graveyard Shift. It is a Stephen King short story adaptation by director Ralph S. Singleton. Does not have real good ratings on IMDb, which I think is unfortunate, because it was a hell of a fun little creature feature from, like I said, 1990, early 90s. It basically centers on a kid who's out of school, played by David Andrews, out of college, and he's looking for basically a temporary job. He ends up at an old textile mill that's kind of like run down. They're trying to repair the place, but it's a lot of just like shoddy working conditions and really shitty pay. It basically has the world's worst rat infestation you've ever seen in your life. And not only because there are, I mean, this thing is just, talk about practical effects, just dozens, maybe hundreds of rats just littering the set. So if you have a phobia of those little critters, then you might want to pass on this one. But it also stars Stephen Mocht as the sort of the foreman, who's kind of a douche. Fans of horror would also recognize Brad Dourif. He plays the exterminator. You'd probably know him best as the serial killer Charles Lee Ray and the voice of Chucky from the Child's Play movies. So those are the guys you would probably recognize from this. But this is one that's kind of overlooked. It used to play on TV every once in a while because it's a short movie. It's only about an hour and a half. A lot of fun. The plot basically goes into the bowels of this textile mill and trying to flush out the rat infestation in pretty interesting ways, and a, kind of a shocker of an ending. So yeah, definitely check that one out if you've never even heard of it before. Graveyard Shift.
Okay, my recommendation will be Rosemary's Baby, which I watched a few days ago. I watched it on Halloween night, and obviously wanted to talk about it because of Roman Polanski. This was his first American film. He had been a big success in Europe with Repulsion and A Knife in the Water, and he came over, and this was an adaptation. And the plot centers on a young woman named Rosemary and her husband Joe, who's an aspiring actor, but he is sort of stuck to bit parts. They want to move to a place in New York. They find this really great place. The realtor does tell them that yes, this place has a bit of a history. Or maybe it's their friend, but someone tells them that this place did have some witchcraft here and some strange going-ons back in the early 1900s, but it's okay now because the woman who lived here is, you know, she died and it's fine. It's a good price and a good neighborhood and a nice place, and yeah, that stuff is kind of weird, but it shouldn't shoo you off from a great apartment. It's like, oh, okay, well, sometimes weird shit is a big flashing light not to do something. So they move in, and they're a very happy couple. And then they have these sort of weird elderly neighbors who are sort of aggressively friendly. But Rosemary does want to have a child. She wants to start a family. But she gets drugged by her husband and then basically raped by a demon. And the question is, almost up to a point, it's like, did this even happen in her mind? Because it's very dreamlike in a sense, but it does develop into a paranoid thriller of sorts, but also kind of a horror film, because this is a woman who basically, she's very protective of her baby, and she believes that a cult of witches is out to get it, but she doesn't even really understand how bad it really is. And so there's sort of a Hitchcockian, you know, the wrong, everyone thinks I'm crazy, but I'm not, that it is paranoid and everyone's out to get me and you can't explain it, but it's still just, it's horrifying because of the circumstances of it. To be in Rosemary's, played by Mia Farrow, who is just great. She has this sort of pixie haircut that is, in a way, it kind of makes her androgynous, and yet it actually makes Farrow have to sort of work harder to assert her femininity, which in turn makes the motherhood of it feel more acute. And so it's just a great film, and John Cassavetes plays her husband. Yeah, he does, and obviously John Cassavetes went on to direct a few good movies. A few, such as, you know, a killing of a Chinese bookie, woman under the influence, you know, little stuff like that. And so that's really good. And then, oh gosh, Ralph Bellamy plays the creepy doctor who's
Yes,
I know, right? It was one of the Dukes is the horrible satanic doctor. It's fantastic. It's a really good movie. It's just, it's a good drama. It's a good horror film. It's in the Criterion Collection, and it's definitely worth checking out.
Rose. Surprisingly, Graveyard Shift, not Criterion Collection.
Well, you know, not it'll yet. Get it just because it's not in the Criterion Collection now.
Oh, fingers crossed, man.
They'll run out of titles eventually.
Eventually,
they're
like, Graveyard Shift?
All right, so thanks for listening. Next week, we'll be back with Thor, The Dark World. I can only hear the word because of that Conan O'Brien sketch where in the first Thor was about to come out, they redid the trailers and they redubbed him to have a really high-pitched girly voice. So he's like, I'm Thor! Curse smash! To just completely ruin the character name for me. But I'm interested to see how it turn out. I think it'll be a good episode to maybe sort of where is Marvel now, because things have changed a little bit. Last time we were talking about Iron Man 3, we were talking more about the way they surprised and audience expectations. Thor, from what I've been hearing, is definitely more standard. I think it's a surprise in terms of how it's different than what they've been marketing as it in terms of tone. But again, we'll get into it. So if you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw, MD.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.